Lecture 26, American Language, from Webster to Mencken.
For Noah Webster, the American language uniquely reflected the American experience. In my previous lecture, I began talking about Webster, and I quoted from his writings from the 1790s and also from the preface to the Great American Dictionary of 1828, and I called attention to the ways in which Webster sought to record the differences between American and British English, but also, in effect, to prescribe changes in American spelling and pronunciation, habits of grammar. His claim that the American language required differences was keyed to the notion of American politics as demanding differences. And so the relationship between the locution and the nation was central to Webster's idea. And what I'd like to do in this lecture is build on some of those observations, return to some of the quotations in greater detail, and trace an arc of attitude for the American 19th century. I'm going to go back to Webster, and I'm going to end with H.L. Mencken, the great journalist and public commentator who in 1919 published the first edition of his magisterial work, The American Language. And so the arc of my discussion moves from the late 18th to the beginning of the 20th century, and it hinges on relationships of grammar and style, culture and commerce, idiom and identity. Now, Webster began his career, as I had mentioned in my previous lecture, by publishing grammar textbooks in the 1780s. And as early as 1806, he published a short dictionary. And what he was trying to do was define the characteristics of American English, what was different about American English from British English, and, as I mentioned, the independence of America as both a political and a linguistic phenomenon. I want to return to that key phrase from my previous lecture, the idea of a national language as a band of national union. The idea that the former colonies were forged into a nation, not simply by sharing political or geographical experience, but by sharing linguistic experience. And this image of the band of national union, Webster is very, very aware, as a lexicographer, of etymology. And he knew that at the heart of words for law and legalism were those old Latin terms, going back even to the Indo-European, for binding, ligature, ligare, to bind things together. And so the laws, quite literally or quite etymologically, bound Americans into a national union. And the job of Webster's lexicography was similarly to forge these bands, both the legal and the linguistic. In 1828, he published his American Dictionary, and he synthesized really three decades of work into language. Language is the expression of ideas, he stated, and he made it quite clear that the words of the English language were keyed to the experiences of the speakers. These philosophical and political implications of language use and language theory were central to his notion. We can see, too, how his notion of expression and how the understanding of language itself, as he says, is an issue of preservation of identity. I had mentioned in my previous lecture how words like Congress, Senate, Assembly, and Court are used differently in America than they were in England. And he makes it very, very clear that it's not simply a question of Americans using words differently. He has selected a set of examples in these words that must be distinguished by these key high concept terms of political identity. In a sense, Webster is also anticipating the work of the Oxford English Dictionary, for he's not simply going back to Johnson, he's looking ahead. And part of what he's looking ahead to is the idea of writing national history through lexicography. This is a dictionary of the people. Now, the American Dictionary had many new features, and I'd like to talk in a little bit of detail about what specifically Webster did to the English language. First, he was very concerned with issues of spelling. He advocated what we might call a moderate spelling reform. And so what he was interested in doing was he was interested in respelling British words into American form. Now, for American readers today, the most obvious difference between British and American spelling is the use of O-R or O-U-R in words like honor and color. Americans spell it H-O-N-O-R, and British writers spell it H-O-N-O-U-R. This is a Websterian innovation. But it's also true that there are other differences that Webster located and sought to change. For example, he advocated dropping the C in certain kinds of words that ended in CK. Now, in the 18th century and at the beginning of the 19th century, British writers would have written words like music, logic, physic, with a CK, M-U-S-I-C-K. And Webster felt that this K was useless. It was excrescent. It did not tell you anything about the pronunciation. And so he pared it away. He wanted words like theater and center to reflect their pronunciation. And so he wanted them spelled with E-R at the end rather than R-E. And he wanted a word like defense, spelled D-E-F-E-N-S-E, rather than D-E-F-E-N-C-E. What Webster's doing is he's arguing that spelling should be more representative of pronunciation than British convention had it. And so he favored the elimination of certain silent letters or letter clusters that were not pronounced. And in this, Webster really bequeaths to generations of American students the very idea of the silent letter. In other words, the issue is not simply that there are certain words in which letters exist and we don't pronounce them. The issue is that there is a concept in English language spelling, and that concept is the silent letter. In my earlier lectures, I distinguished between two kinds of silent letters. Letters that were originally pronounced, that is, that represented sounds of earlier stages in the language where the spelling was etymological and historical. And these are words like knight instead of knisht, or knee instead of knay, and through instead of thruch. There are other kinds of silent letters which were introduced by 17th and 18th century spelling reformers who wanted words to reflect what they imagined to be their Latin etymologies, even if these words did not enter directly through Latin. And so spelling doubt and debt with a B, these are learned reformations of the words that never had the B in any historical English form, because the words actually came in through French after the B had been lost from the Latin. So what Webster is really talking about is a concept. And the concept is that American spelling should moderately, he's not a radical reformer, but should moderately be reformed in order to represent the sounds of speech, and also to economize, if you like, the number of letters used in a given word. Webster also recorded newer American pronunciations. His Dictionary of 1828 came with a pronunciation guide, and he advocated, as I mentioned earlier, full syllable count in the words. Necessary and secretary, not necessary and secretary. Webster is in many ways like an American version of Samuel Johnson. His job is to create a dictionary that is an arbiter of language use, that ostensibly describes, but at the same time, of course, prescribes, and that frames itself with an elaborate preface keyed to organicist metaphors of language and language change. At the close of my last lecture, I read from the preface of his dictionary, and I called attention to the way in which Webster developed these Johnsonian organic metaphors, the images of the river or the images of the landscape that make the language into what it is, something natural, something unchainable, something uncontrollable. And I called attention to the way in which Webster considered language like the course of the Mississippi. And I want to go back to that phrase now because it's a very important one. And he said, it's quite impossible to stop the progress of language. It's like the course of the Mississippi, the motion of which at times is scarcely perceptible, yet even then it possesses a moment quite irresistible. And now I will continue with the quote, more than what I read last time. Words and expressions, he said, will be forced into use in spite of all the exertions of all the writers of the world. And so what's happening is that new words will be coming into the language, and that the language will be changing much as a river flows. I also want to call attention to the way in which Webster uses the image of the Mississippi, because I think this is going to be a nodal point in the American literary imagination. The fact is not simply that the Mississippi River exists, or that it is the defining geographical feature that bifurcates the American continent. The fact is that beginning really with the age of Webster, it is the image of the Mississippi that stands as the exemplary figure for American identity. And so, just as Webster can talk about the course of the Mississippi, so Mark Twain can locate the story of Huckleberry Finn on the Mississippi. The image is not simply the image of the river journey in a kind of general or historical sense. It's not simply a trope. It is uniquely the American river. Or even go as far as T.S. Eliot, who in one of his great poems, one of the four quartets, begins by talking about the Mississippi River, when he says, I don't know much about rivers, but I think the river is a great brown god. And he talks about his imagery here, a man now writing in England, but someone who goes back to his childhood in St. Louis on the Mississippi, the great brown god of the river. And so for Webster and for his followers, the Mississippi is a great brown god. Now, I want to use that too as something of a segue to some of Webster's influence. For Webster influenced not simply white, but brown and black. That Webster's readers were not simply or not only the New Englanders who bought his books, or the owners of books, but they were also the owners of slaves. And perhaps no more poignant moment in American literature can be found than in the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, who in the 19th century recorded his experiences, both literary and cultural. Frederick Douglass, who in so many ways represents the beginnings of codifying African-American literary culture in America. Frederick Douglass talks about how when he was a child, a slave in Baltimore, and how as a slave boy, he surreptitiously learned to read and write. His master's son, Tommy, had a copy of Webster's spelling book. And Douglass talks about how he copied out the italics of Webster's spelling book. And as he says in his autobiography, he copied them out, quote, until I could make them all without looking in the book. And he goes on to say how in that copybook, quote, in the ample spaces between the lines, I wrote other lines as nearly like his as possible. My question is this. Is American literature written between Webster's lines? For Douglass, the emergence into literacy comes after much trial, hearing his mistress read the Bible and learning to spell a few words, watching the carpenters in the Baltimore shipyard marking the initials on timbers for the placement of a ship. Douglass learns to copy, and soon, as he says, and I quote, with playmates for my teachers, fences and pavements for my copybooks, and chalk for my pen and ink, I learned to write. And so, Webster is at the heart of Douglass's learning of literacy, much as he is at the heart of the American literate and literary experience. How does Webster's afterlife work through in other 19th century writers? Let me review some of the legacies of 19th century remarks on linguistics, and let me focus on some of the ways in which we can trace the development from Webster to Mencken. After Webster, there is a debate on what constitutes an Americanism, and there are some very interesting figures worth noting. John Pickering published in 1816 a work called A Dictionary of Americanisms, which Webster considered an attack on his position. His argument, Pickering's argument, was that Americanisms are individual locutions rather than the building blocks of American social and linguistic consciousness. And so this is a radically different position from Webster's. In 1848, a man named John Bartlett published another book of Americanisms. And here, the work is primarily about regional dialect. What's emerging in the course of the 19th century is a recognition of Americanisms, or the American language, as, if you like, the sum of American regional dialects. And Americanism comes to connote not just a word or a locution different from one used in Great Britain, but rather a word or locution that is fundamentally regional or folk in origin. That is, something that distinguishes everyday regional, folk, or local speech from a learned or inherited literate standard. James Russell Lowell, one of the great arbiters of literature and language of the late 19th century, published in 1866 a series of what he called the Bigelow Papers. And his second series of Bigelow Papers, in these essays, he argued that many of the things that we think of as characteristic of American speech are really holdovers of earlier British speech. Now, I've already mentioned this idea, in other words, that American regionalism maintains pockets of archaism. And to some extent, what Lowell is interested in is locating American English in a larger historical trajectory. In other words, it's not simply a matter of regional difference. It's not simply a matter of difference from the British Isles. It rather is the sense that the American language has a history as deep as that of the English of Britain, and that that history looks back to earlier archaisms and forms. This is the group that's really leading up to the work of H.L. Mencken. and his American Language, published originally in 1919, went through many revisions and expansions in the course of the next three decades, and his work was primarily concerned with tracing the history of American English. But he was also concerned with defining just what distinguished American English from other forms. So let me read to you the passage from Mencken's work in which he begins by describing what he calls the hallmarks of American. And he says, and I quote, "The characters chiefly noted in American English are first, its general uniformity throughout the country. Second, its impatient disregard for grammatical, syntactical, and phonological rule and precedent. And third, its large capacity, distinctly greater than that of the English of present-day England, for taking new words and phrases from outside sources and for manufacturing them of its own materials." Mencken's claims here are the claims going back to Witherspoon, the idea that American English is more generally uniform than British English, largely because of patterns of movement and migration, that even though there may be regional dialects, the differences between dialects are not as great as those between the dialects of the regions of Great Britain. And secondly, the way in which American speakers seem to speak, now to use Witherspoon's words, without propriety. They have improprieties. Again, Witherspoon, in talking about improprieties, is using the word in its 18th century Johnsonian sense of grammatical differences. And Mencken is picking up on that when he talks about this impatient disregard for grammatical, syntactical, and phonological rule or precedent. And third, the sort of voracity of Americans for new words. That is, that the American language is going to have a larger vocabulary than the English language in England because Americans are more willing to bring in new words or they're more willing to coin words. And let's now go back to the imagery. In Witherspoon, Witherspoon talks about how he coined the word Americanism. And as he says, that it's exactly similar to the word Scotticism, that is, a form of English spoken in Scotland, which already is a word in the 18th century. So, coining words, he's investing in a traditional mercantile metaphor for coming up with new vocabulary. What Mencken is doing, writing at the beginning of the 20th century, is he is responding to the burgeoning presence of American industry. That we take new words and phrases from outside sources and we manufacture them of our own materials. And so now the American language is like an American factory, where the raw materials of experience are shipped in to be transformed, to be manufactured into the new words of our life. Mencken has an important impact on contemporary attitudes towards American English. And his impact, I think, really lies less in his detailed philological scholarship than in his attentions to what we might call the American rhetorical persona. Now, in my following lecture, I'm going to develop some positions that Mencken articulates about the way in which Americans are a rhetorical people. And I'm going to look at the way in which American public and literary rhetoric gives rise to and defines a notion of selfhood keyed to the American national experience. But for now, I want to turn to another brilliant quotation from Mencken, from the same chapter on the hallmarks of American, where he talks about what distinguishes American language. And he's going on and he's talking about new words coming in. He's talking about the way in which regional words or folk etymologies can be used. But here's what he says. He says, more important than the sheer inventions, if only because more numerous, are the extensions of the vocabulary by the devices of rhetoric. The American, from the beginning, has been the most ardent of recorded rhetoricians. His politics bristles with pungent epithets. His whole history has been bedizened with tall talk. His fundamental institutions rest far more upon brilliant phrases than upon logical ideas. He exercises continually an incomparable capacity for projecting hidden and often fantastic relationships into his speech. This is as brilliant a passage on American language as Johnson's or Webster's or Witherspoon's might be on the languages of their own time and place. And like so many of the writers that I've read, it is also in itself a brilliant example of great language use. Look at his vocabulary. Ardent. This is a Johnsonian word. Johnson was fascinated by the word ardent because it challenged him. Should we define the word according to its literal historical meaning, on fire, or should we define it according to its newer metaphorical usage, that is, sort of emotionally aflame or burning with desire? Mencken deliberately chooses this word to remind us of exactly how Americans are not simply ardent, but that the history of the word ardent encapsulates his history of the language, the move from the literal to the metaphorical. Ardent of recorded rhetoricians, alliteration. The words are themselves, if you like, tripped out over the tongue in alliteration. Politics bristles. This is another great word that I talked about, where you have bristle spiking. It's as if the language itself is now bristling. This is, again, a favorite Milton word, the idea of bristling. And of course, the Latin bristle is horrid, and something is horrible, something is bristling, but now it's bristling with what? Pungent epithets, as if the words themselves had the smell and smoke of Milton's hell about them. His whole history, alliteration, has been bedizened with tall talk. The only place that Mencken could have gotten the word bedizened, I'm convinced, is out of Samuel Johnson's dictionary. Ornamented, tricked out, trappings. And so, whole history, tall talk, you have two phrases that alliterate, and you have tall talk. You have the monosyllables of the Anglo-Saxon juxtaposed against the polysyllables of the Latinate and the learned. His fundamental institutions, big gun, polysyllabic, Latinate words, because we're talking about important, high-concept things, rest far more on brilliant phrases than logical ideas, and once again, he exercises continually an incomparable capacity. Notice how Mencken is playing with the polysyllabic here for projecting hidden and often fantastic relationships. Almost every big word here is a polysyllable into his speech. And what is the example that Mencken gives for this remarkable quality of the ardent American? He says, such a term as rubberneck is almost a complete treatise on American psychology. It has precisely the boldness and contempt for ordered forms that are so characteristically American. Why choose the word rubberneck? What does rubberneck mean? To rubberneck is to drive by a train wreck, or to stare, to stick your neck out as if it were made of rubber. And Mencken wants to see in it a complete treatise on American psychology. But what we see, too, is it embodies a complete treatise on the American language. For what better way to describe Mencken Witherspoon, and Webster than, as if you like, the linguistic rubberneckers of the world. They drive by, they look, they see, they notice, and they pause, and in the process, they hold up the traffic of everyday life. As I stretch my neck out in these lectures, I want you, too, to think of how we've rubbernecked onto the language from old and middle to modern English, and how in that act of rubbernecking, we've defined ourselves as an American public culture, a culture whose national language is a band of national union.